Okay, we'll move now to the prophet Habakkuk. And as you can see, he's at bridging the turn of the century, starting about 605, reasons I'll explain in a moment, and living through the capture of Jerusalem in 598. But it's not apparent from his words that he experienced the actual destruction of Jerusalem, which was 587. So he's a contemporary, though for a briefer period, of Jeremiah. You might note, or please note now, I won't be here next week. I'm not actually sure why I'm not here, but anyhow, I'm not. I thought it must have been a public holiday or whatever the reason is. So I won't be here next week, but the 2 weeks after we'll be looking at Jeremiah, and Jeremiah's quite special. So, and I'm doing it in 2 weeks, which is maybe not very sensible, but we could spend two months on Jeremiah. And Jeremiah is a contemporary of Habakkuk. We'll do it over a couple of weeks. And if you do want to read ahead and enjoy Jeremiah to the full, don't forget, I've got those books over there. You're welcome to buy them and read ahead and do what you like with them. So let's now begin having a look at Habakkuk. And I've got a little bit of history to fill up from where we were with the others. In 609, the Assyrian army suffered a crushing defeat at Haran, which is Syria now, but north of Palestine. The pharaoh of Egypt, whose name was Necho, was heading north to assist Assyria, but he was delayed by Josiah in the plain of Megiddo, and Josiah was killed in the battle. 609. And that was actually a colossal trauma for Judah, because in their theology, and you're aware of it now, we've done enough on it, punishment of God is anger, and it's also because of bad behavior, etc., etc., etc. Here they're dealing with an ideal king. You saw already with Zephaniah, while he complained about all the other people, he never complained about Josiah. So here you've got, he was young, he died at 39 or something, still in his late 30s. He'd reformed the country, he'd obeyed the Torah, he'd done all anyone could be expected to do. He was the Messiah, like he was the new king, the promised one, and all their hopes were on him. Yet he's killed. Well, what does that do to you? There are people around, you may be among them. If you are, I can't imagine you're staying here for too long. But really, there are people who if something shakes the position they're in, they just duck and the wave and they stay where they are. But if we're going to actually explore reality, which we've all got to do, honestly, well, then of course we're going to have... So they went through a pretty shaky period. And it's going to be followed quickly, unfortunately, and we'll do that tonight too, by the capture of their own city, Jerusalem, which they thought could never be captured because it's God's city, God's temple. And this proved the Babylonian God was stronger than their God. And that can't be the case. So there's a lot of faith shattering happening in these traumatic years, but it begins with the unexpected, unexplainable death of their favourite king in his youth, Josiah. The kingmakers in Judah bypassed Josiah's eldest son, whose name was Eliakim, and they chose as king his younger brother, whose name was Shallum. Often in the Bible you'll find these kings have two names. They have their own name, but then when they become king they get a throne name, which is kind of symbolic of their agenda and their propaganda and what they hope to do and things like that. So his real name is Shallum. He took the throne name of Jehoahaz. Ahaz, Yahweh, etc. And you'll find that in the book of Jeremiah and Chronicles.
Do you know the meaning of Jehoahaz?
No, I don't. I'm sorry. Except, no, I do, but I can't remember. They hoped he would continue the policies of his father Josiah. However, Necho, the pharaoh, wasn't going to allow this little rump state of Judah to have a king who would be pro the other or anti Egyptian. So he chose Eliakim, the one they'd overlooked, who was given the throne name of Jehoiakim, whose name I'm not exactly sure what that means either. Thus began the unravelling of the independence that Josiah had achieved. They're now a puppet state, too close, and Egypt is getting stronger because Assyria is getting weaker. It doesn't take so. There's some maps now. Again, we've got our little Judah here and Jerusalem, and that's the larger map. And we have Babylon here. Up here is Nineveh, which has been destroyed by this time. Carchemish is going to be mentioned. It's on the Euphrates River, Carchemish, which I'll mention here. Because in 605, it was the key battle. Nebuchadnezzar, the new king of Babylon, he defeated the Assyrians and the Egyptians together at Carchemish, one of the great battles of the ancient world. And we're going to see a couple of things we'll have to look at in a minute. 598 to 597, Jerusalem is captured by the Babylonians, this new force that Nahum didn't foresee coming, but that's what the... And Jehoiakim has taken into exile in 597. Because the king, Jehoiakim, he died during the siege of the city, and his young son took over as king, but he was only there for 3 months. And thank God the city wasn't destroyed, because he capitulated. And then he was taken to exile along with anyone who'd be good for the war cause back in Babylon. And the ordinary people, the farmers, were left. Right. Well, that's our history. In 598... Nebuchadrezzar, and you've got to watch his name if you're interested. Sometimes it has an N in some of the Old Testament books. Sometimes it's got an R, and the R seems to be more accurate to the Babylonian language, so I'm calling him Nebuchadrezzar. But you will find Nebuchadnezzar as well. Okay. They attacked Judah and besieged Jerusalem. Jehoiakim died during the siege. He was succeeded briefly by his 18-year-old son, Jeconiah, sometimes called Coniah, who took the throne name Jehoiakim. He reigned for the first 3 months of 597 BC. He decided to surrender, the siege was lifted, taken into exile in Babylon, along with the leading citizens. Nebuchadrezzar replaced him by another of Josiah's sons, Mattaniah, Jehoiakim's uncle, who was given the throne name Zedekiah. One happened to know that. Zedek is justice, and Yahweh's justice, the justice of Yahweh. He was given that name, and now we move straight into the brief, but quite, well, you make your own assessment of it. The prophecy of Habakkuk, or the scroll, the literary scroll, which is the fruit of the public statements of this otherwise unknown Judah man called Habakkuk. The oracle that prophet Habakkuk saw. Frequently that's what you'll find. An oracle is a words that he spoke, but he saw them before he spoke them. So it's the seer, as they see it, like they're looking into the mind of God, looking into the mystery of seeing what we're blind to see. Enlightened might be another way of putting it. So it's an oracle that comes out of his enlightenment by God, according to those who treasured his scroll. Yahweh, how long must I cry for help, and you do not listen? Or cry to you violence, and I gave you this once before, the Hebrew is Hamas, hence the Hamas movement present in Gaza. So, cry to you violence, and you do not save. Why do you make me see injustice and look on wrongdoing? It's a tumultuous time. Josiah's been killed, you got it? The other king's been put off the throne. Egypt is interfering. Zedekiah's put in, who's one of Josiah's sons. Why do you make me see injustice and look on wrongdoing? Brackets, he could have written, And Nahum just said everything was going to go fine. But he didn't actually say that. Why do you make destruction and plunder are before me? Strife and conflict abound. The law becomes slack. Justice never prevails. The wicked surround the righteous, and justice is perverted. So that's what he saw happening, and that's how he said it. Look at the nations. See, be astonished, be astounded, for a work is being done in your days that you would not believe if you were told. And he goes on to say, I am rousing the Chaldeans. The Chaldeans, that's the racial group of Babylon. So he's talking about this new group from southern Iraq, Babylon, that is rising up, and it's already conquered Assyria and Egypt together. So it's that's Yahweh, see? Because they came up, Yahweh must be raising them up. You got the logic? It's not accurate, it's not factual, but that's how he saw it. That fierce and impetuous nation who march through the breadth of the earth to seize dwellings not their own. Dread and fearsome are they. Their justice and dignity proceed from themselves, not from Yahweh, but their own pride, etc. Their horses are swifter than leopards, more menacing than wolves at dusk. Their horses charge. Their horsemen come from far away. They fly like an eagle, swift to devour. I just had a flashing image there of the people at the time of Napoleon. You know how his armies used to move so swiftly. He caught everybody off guard because he used to march them through the night. And so these people are nothing to do with this, of course. That was just a distraction. But it goes on. They've got weapons of war now and methods of warfare that are new and very effective. They fly like an eagle, swift to devour. They all come for violence, with faces pressing forward. They gather captives like sand. At kings they scoff, at rulers they make sport. They laugh at every fortress. They heap up earth to take it, as they did, you know, to make the ramp, to take rampart. They heap up earth to take it. Then they sweep by like the wind. They transgress and become guilty. Their own might is their God. Are you not from of old, Yahweh? Now, the suggestion is that this is written after the fall of Jerusalem. The other part was earlier. Here we've got, because you only have to tell from internal evidence, so we won't get certainty on this, but the probabilities are there. But this is written after the collapse of Jerusalem, which was just unbelievable and such a shock. Jeremiah will have a lot to say about it. Marvelous insight into it all. Because everyone kept saying, it's the temple of Yahweh. Well, you can't destroy the temple of Yahweh, because Yahweh's on our side and he's God. So, but they were wrong. And Jeremiah kept telling them they're wrong. Well, he's Habakkuk. Are you not from of old, Yahweh, my God, my Holy One? You shall not die, Yahweh. You have marked them for judgment. And you, O rock, have established them for punishment. Your eyes are too pure to behold evil. You cannot look on wrongdoing. Why do you tolerate the treacherous? Good question, arising from a thinking man of the day. Why are you tolerating all this? Why are you allowing Babylon to... What's going on, in other words? You're silent when the wicked swallow those more righteous than they, which is theologically an enormous problem for him. And for us, if we think that God's running the world. If we remember that God is loving the world, but leaving it up to us to run it, we'll react entirely differently. We'll look for where God is, rather than accuse God of doing what's happening. You have made people like the fish of the sea, like crawling things that have no ruler. They're lacking... All the leaders have gone to Babylon, into exile. They're in a mess. The enemy brings all of them up with a hook. You know, he drags them out with his net. He gathers them in his dragnet. He rejoices and exalts the enemy, what they're doing. Therefore, he sacrifices to his net and makes offerings to his dragnet. The Babylonians, they're so proud of their military prowess, they're worshipping it. Has that stopped? For by them his portion is lavish. He enjoys the choicest food. Is he then to keep on emptying his net and destroying nations without mercy? I haven't told you everything, but you see, you've just seen Assyria and Egypt destroyed by Babylon. Well, then you've got Syria, you've got Moab, you've got Ammon, you've got Philistia, you got it, and you've got Judah. So they're sweeping through the whole of the region and taking everything before them without mercy. And it's puzzling this prophet. Of course, I will stand at my watch post, chapter 2 of Habakkuk, and station myself on the rampart. I will keep watch to see what he will say to me and what he'll answer concerning my argument. What's God going to say about this problem that I've got and we've got? You got it? Well, we still have to do that, crying out to God for light. Then Yahweh answered me and said. So he learnt something in the quiet of his own heart, and this is what he learnt. Write the vision. Make it plain on tablets. Now, if it's written down, it's forever. Like, you know, the spoken word can rumble along and get lost in the wind. But if you write something down, that's how they saw it. It's there forever. Make it plain on tablets so that a herald may run with it. For the vision is a guarantee for the appointed time. It bears witness to the end. Things are grim now, but and it doesn't lie. If it seems to tarry, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay. So he's being assured of something here at a level of faith. Look at the proud. Their spirit is not right in them. The righteous lives by his faithfulness. That's a very important text, quoted by St. Paul in the letter to the Romans, which I think you're aware of, but very complex text to get a handle on with any certainty. For example, let me take you through. The righteous, that's the person who lives according to God's will, who does what dike in Greek, who does what is right, who follows the law, who follows God's revelation. So a person who's a just, like they call Joseph in the New Testament, he was a just man. Okay. Lives what? By his faithfulness. Who's the his? Well, it's ambiguous. If you take it as Yahweh's faithfulness, he's saying a righteous person, okay, things are grim, but you will live, it's the promise, and you will live because of God's faithfulness. God is faithful, so you will live.
So that's God's part of the covenant.
It's better if you don't, because I can't record you. Okay. Do you mind?
Sure.
Sorry, it's a good point, but we'll have a talk after. Yeah. So Yahweh puts trust in God's faithfulness. So it's looking beyond us and looking to the fidelity of God, which is what the prophet believes. When and how it'll come, it's true. Or another possibility, the Hebrew is ambiguous, is the righteous. So you will live by your fidelity to the covenant. If you want to live, be faithful to God's covenant with you. Is that okay? Do you see? So that both meanings are clearly possible from the Hebrew, and so we have to just leave it as ambiguous, and both factors are true. It's probably intentionally ambiguous because it's encompassing both God's fidelity and our fidelity to that. Moreover, wealth is treacherous. The arrogant do not endure. They open their throats wide as Sheol, it's the underworld, Hades of the Greeks. Like death, they never have enough. You know, death just loves all of us dying, going down into the grave. And that's why they had these libations, you'd know, in the ancient, or everywhere in the ancient world. They'd have some sacrifices that would go up to heaven, to the sky gods, the smell, etc., and the incense and all that. And they'd have some sacrifices which they'd pour into the thirsty earth and it would drink in the blood of the animals. So it's a bloodthirsty gods of the, I think they call them the chthonic gods, down under there. Well, that's the mythology we're living in, and that's how, so Sheol, the underworld, is thirsty. Death will never have enough. They gather all nations for themselves. They collect all peoples as their own. Shall not everyone taunt such people and with mocking riddles say about them, woe to you who heap up what is not your own. So it's the countries that are, well, gee, that's pretty applicable, isn't it? Yeah. We're guilty of that, I would have thought. As a community, I mean, we live beyond our means, and we're not the only country living beyond our means. We know one particularly well that's living well beyond its means and has to pass through Congress regularly and legislation to up the debt. So whatever's happening, woe to you who heap up what is not your own. How long will you load yourselves with goods taken in pledge? Will not your own creditors suddenly rise and those who make you tremble wake up? Then you'll be booty for them. Like, you're not going to get away with this forever. Someone else is going to, just as you've come up against Assyria, someone's going to come up against you, you know. Then you'll be booty for them because you've plundered many nations. All that survive of the peoples shall plunder you because of human bloodshed and violence to the earth, to cities and all who live in them. Are you following it enough for me? I don't want to comment too much on it because I'm taking it as obvious. Just to get the feel of this. Jerusalem has just been captured is the key thing behind all this. But he's seeing God is enlightening him to say, wait a minute, this is not the end, and they're not going to get away with it forever. A second statement, a second woe. So say about them that. Now say, woe to you, here's another point, who get evil gain for your houses, setting up your nest on high to be safe from the reach of harm. There's images of the eagle there. There's all kinds of poetic images underneath that. You've devised shame for your house by cutting off many peoples. You've fortified your life. The very stones will cry out from the wall and the plaster will respond from the woodwork. Thirdly, woe to you who build a town by bloodshed and found a city on iniquity. Has not Yahweh of hosts determined that people's labor only to feed the flames, and that nations exhaust themselves for nothing? But the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of Yahweh as the waters cover the sea. It's a very memorable and beautiful statement, isn't it? This is trust, this is hope, this is dream, this is hanging on to something that's essential to Yahwism and to us too, of course. A kind of a faith. It's not make-believe, it's not utopian, but it's knowing that there's something more to life than what's happening in our community at the moment, and holding on to it firmly because it's at the basis of their of Yahwism, of the faith of the people. And their faith is that the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of Yahweh. Can you imagine how that, what that phrase would have meant to St. Paul of Tarsus, hearing that, and from his, I'm jumping, but if you don't mind me jumping, and from his seeing what was happening to Judaism and how it was being, it was too locked in, and then as a Pharisee and as a highly educated Jew and Greek, both, he saw Christianity, he saw Jesus' Judaism, let's put it that way, as a way of taking the Torah, which he loved, to the ends of the earth, free of the limitations of the cult and the circumcision, you know, all the bits and pieces that tribally identified them. And we've got to be careful. If people will want to identify us, don't worry. As I'm not assuming you're all Catholic by any means, but I am, so I'll talk about me and the... So with Catholicism or any other religion, because when it gets a little bit insecure, will start to want to identify itself by something small. You know what I mean? Nothing wrong with those small things to identify us. By all means, we need to belong. But what should identify Catholicism is Catholicism. Openness to embrace the whole world. A kind of a vision of humanity that's as big as Teilhard de Chardin and Gerard Manley Hopkins and Thomas Aquinas and Augustine and Mary MacKillop and the saints. Do you get it? Like, it's got to be a big thing that we identify with, because the world's got well past. We've seen it as a little blue globe from the outer space. We've got beyond identifying as tribes, haven't we? So, well, now how I got onto that, don't ask me. But anyhow, here he is saying, promising, the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of Yahweh, and we should be looking out for that everywhere, as the waters cover the sea. Again, he's not quite quoting, but drawing on Isaiah. They're drawing on each other, a tradition. A fourth statement now. There's a few. Oh, yeah, that's it. Woe to you. So these his different criticisms of Babylon and of the people who are losing their perspective and thinking we've got to become more like them or whatever. Woe to you who make your neighbours drink, pouring out your wrath until they're drunk in order to gaze on their nakedness. You're buying up these people. This is commercial stuff. It's not talking about physical nakedness here, which is nothing. But here he's talking about, you know, they're sucking people into their system, but they're losing out. They can't possibly compete. You'll be sated with contempt instead of glory, says the prophet. Drink you yourself and stagger. The cup in Yahweh's right hand will come around to you, and shame will come upon your glory. You'll lose everything of value if you buy into this Babylonian method of living. For the violence done to Lebanon will overwhelm you. The destruction of animals will terrify you. Because of human bloodshed and violence, here's your Hamas again, to the earth, to cities, and all who live in them. Oh, fifth. What use is an idol once its maker has shaped it? You're aware, a lot of the prophets, it'll become increasingly so when they go to Babylon, are aware of man-made things, and don't forget theology is man-made, and the scriptures are man-made. You okay with all that, I presume? And canon law is man-made, by the way. Man-made and man-human. These are all human things. God is beyond everything like this. So we can idolize what we make, can't we? We can worship our creation instead of being drawn by the wonderful things that people do to the mystery of the divine and sacred at the heart of our universe. Well, what's the use of an idol once its maker has shaped it? A cast image, a teacher of lies. Its maker trusts in what has been made, though the product's only an idol. It can't speak. He's looking at the Babylonian gods, eh? Woe to you who say to wood, wake up, or to silent stone, rouse yourself. Can it teach? It's gold and silver plated. There's no breath in it. Now, they misunderstood the Babylonians, of course, because they thought they were worshipping these idols. You know, I can remember when I was at university, the chaplain, he was Anglican chaplain, he wasn't real Anglican, though. He was against any... why am I telling you this? Do you mind if I finish it now that I've told you? There was a woman there who at the uni who was met her husband, in a, I suppose it's simply a psychiatric place in Canada somewhere. And so she was pretty tender psychically, you know, but a lovely person. And she, her she used to come to the Mass with the others, but her contribution was not talk or anything, but she'd make little hangings, and she was able to do that. It was rather beautiful. And when she left the university, I suppose, as an act of gratitude to us for the way, I guess, the husband saw us as caring for her. We didn't see it that way. We saw her as caring for us, but it was a community thing. But he made out of almost brown coal. It was just it was really, really ancient, from Victoria, wood that was thousands of years old and almost got to the coal stage. Out of one piece of wood, he carved a crucifix. It's kind of ugly, but poignant, you know. And it was exactly the shape I didn't see the original, but his aim was to make it like the crucifix that was back there in Canada where he met his wife. So it was a beautiful thing to do, you know, a beautiful gift, really. So naively, in a way, and unthinkingly, and looking back, it wasn't appropriate, what I did. I just, because we were the ones who used the chapel all the time for Mass and various, twice a day sometimes, but the Anglican group would come in and just for a talk at midday once a week or something like that. So I didn't think of them, which is not to my credit, but I hung it behind the altar because it was just a lovely gift for, and we're saying Mass there every day. And then it vanished. It just vanished. We couldn't find it anywhere. And finally, it turned up in a cupboard. So then I found out that the Anglican chaplain had organised people to take it. So I went to see him to understand why. And I'm sorry, but it's related to this. He said, "Oh, well, you worship wood." I said, "No, we don't." You know, like, I said, "We don't worship it. It's a piece of wood." I said, "If you were dying of cold, I'd give it to you to burn in the fire. That's not what we're doing. And then I told him about it. He wasn't listening. And he said, "Yes, you do worship it." And I said, "No, I don't." Then when he said, "Yes, you do," again, I thought, hello, we're back in the playground now. I thought, how can he tell me what I'm doing when I'm trying to tell him what we don't do? But anyhow, he insisted. So then I did something much better, of course. I would put it up for Mass and then take it down and so that it wouldn't offend him or his group, which I should have thought of doing in the first place. But I've told you that because here we've got I'll have to use the word intelligent, an intelligent man who thinks that we were actually worshipping a piece of wood. Do you know what I mean? And he said, "You can't." And then he'd quote Leviticus or anywhere. Where I said to him, in fact, I thought this was a good punchline, but I always think what I say is good, so just watch it. I said, "Do you like preaching?" And he did. He loves it. I said, "Well, you weave words into something in order to communicate your love of God, don't you?" He said, "Yes." I said, "This person did it with wood." It's just another artistic way of giving expression to, and it takes us to the mystery of God's love and all that. But anyhow, he wasn't listening. But here we are back here. So they had a similar misunderstanding, because the Babylonians weren't worshipping bits of wood. That was their kind of symbol or their physical presence of the gods, you know, who were, of course, mysteriously spiritual. But he's speaking from his perspective, because they didn't have any images of God. And that's wonderful, because they saw God was beyond all images. But they were in danger of worshipping their cult or their book. Do you know what I mean? You can worship the Bible or you can worship cult. We can hang on to anything for our security, and we're not allowed to, except love. Yahweh is in his holy temple. That's heaven. Because the temple at the moment is not in too good a shape. Let all the earth keep silence before him. In the light of that, I should stop talking, but will you forgive me if I don't keep silence and just finish off chapter 3 and then... Chapter 3 is an extraordinary little thing. It's a psalm. Now, it's a psalm. You could easily put this straight into the book of Psalms, and that's where you think it belongs. Did Habakkuk write it? I don't know. Did he have it handy and put it he himself say it out loud because it summed up his insight, quite likely. Did later scribes find it and think, gee, this is what Habakkuk was really getting at all the time, and put it into the scroll when it was written? Likely. Do you get it? Well, there's a lot of uncertainties here. But either way, it's been preserved for us, not in the book of Psalms, but in the prophecy of Habakkuk. So someone, not long afterwards, considered it appropriate to Habakkuk. And when I read it or studied it, I can't find anything in it that would say, no, it certainly doesn't fit Habakkuk. It could well be his. It begins. This is a prayer of the prophet Habakkuk according to Shiginoth. We don't know what that means, but if you look up Psalm 7, it's probably a musical thing. It's probably a hint as to how to sing it. It's probably a something for the orchestra or for the people who are playing their harp. An instruction, in other words. You find that regularly through the book of Psalms. They have these... We don't know the reasons for them, but they have little hints like that. In other words, we would probably say psalm inserted to the tune of Allons au fond de la patrie, or something like that, if you're French. You got it? Right on cue, John. Or a tune just like that.
Apologies.
No, it's perfect timing. Well, that is exactly what a Shigionoth is. Okay. So it's a prayer. Yahweh, I've heard of your renown. I stand in awe, Yahweh, of your work, of what you've done. In our own time, revive it. In our own time, make it known. In wrath, may you remember mercy. In other words, when we feel your anger, don't forget your mercy. God came from Teman. Teman is a mountain in the south of in Edom, so southeast of Edom. The Holy One came from Mount Paran. So at certain times of the year, that's where the sun would rise. And then it says, Selah. And you find that S-E-L-A-H often in the Psalms. Don't know how many times, I should know, but I've forgotten. And my suggestion to you, only because it seems to be the most likely alternative, but you won't find any certainty on this, is that Selah means quiet, let's have a musical interlude. John, you got it again? A musical interlude to let us listen to the word, like the psalm should be in today's Eucharist, in today's Mass. It's not meant to be another reading, it's meant to be let your right brain get a go. And it's meant to be sung, really. And if you can, please do it, even no matter how simply, because it's not extra information, it's a playing on the first reading in a prayerful way. His glory, so after that interlude, his glory covered the heavens. The earth was full of his praise. The brightness was like the sun. Rays came forth from his hand where his power lay hidden. Before him went pestilence, and plague followed close behind. He stopped and shook the earth. He looked and made the nations tremble. We've seen a lot of that. The eternal mountains were shattered. Along his ancient pathways, the everlasting hills sank low. That's poetry again. I saw the tents of Cushan. We don't know where that is, under affliction. The tent curtains of the land of Midian trembled. Midian's near the Red Sea. Was your wrath against the rivers, Yahweh, or your anger against the rivers, or your rage against the sea when you drove your horses and your chariots to victory? You brandished your naked bow, sated with the arrows at your command. So every arrow hit its mark. And then with that little bit of, you get again a little bit of musical interlude. You split the earth with rivers. The mountains saw you and writhed. A torrent of water swept by. The deep gave forth its voice. The grumbling, the earthquake stuff. The sun raised high its hands and the moon stood still in its exalted place. At the light of your arrows speeding by, you know what they are, lightning, flashes. At the gleam of your flashing spear, in fury you trod the earth, in anger you trampled nations. Yahweh, you came forth to save your people, to save your anointed. You crushed the head of the wicked house, laying it bare from foundations to roof. And then we come to the conclusion of Habakkuk. You pierced with his arrows the head of his warriors, who came like a whirlwind to scatter us, gloating as if ready to devour the poor who were in hiding. You trampled the sea with your horses, churning the mighty waters. I hear and I tremble within. My lips quiver at the sound. Rottenness enters into my bones, and my steps tremble beneath me. I wait quietly for the day of calamity to come upon the people who attack us. And then comes, I think it's the most remarkable statement of faith in the Old Testament. So the poetry is, they're in a dreadful state, but he's still putting his trust in God's justice somehow. I wait quietly. I'm sorry, I can't fix that. I've got it badly done on here. I wait quietly for the calamity to come upon the people who attack us. Here's the conclusion. Though the fig tree does not blossom, and there's no fruit on the vines, though the produce of the olive fails, and the fields yield no food, though the flock is cut off from the fold, and there's no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in Yahweh, I will exult in the God of my salvation. Yahweh the Lord is my strength. He makes my feet like the feet of a deer. He makes me tread upon the heights. What an extraordinary statement of faith. Though everything's going around me, though there's no reason to hope, though everything's collapsing, and it was, though the city's in mess, and the countryside's been ravaged by war, and the fires of, I'll read it to you again, though the fig tree doesn't blossom, though there's no fruit on the vine, though the produce of the olive fails and the fields yield no food, so we're at the grimmest we can be, though the flock is cut off from the fold, and there's no cattle in the stalls, though all that happens, he knows what he's going to do. It's really quite beautiful. I will rejoice in Yahweh. I will exult in the God who saves me, the God that I put my trust in. Yahweh, the Lord, is my strength. He makes my feet like those of a deer and makes me tread on the heights. And at the end, typical of a psalm, to the choir master with stringed instruments is the instruction given to your beautiful choir.